Welcome into the QB SCO Show. This is episode 37, brought to you by the Five Folk at SB Nation and Bleeding Green Nation. I'm your host, Michael Kist. You can follow me on Twitter at Michael Kist NFL. That's K-I-S-T. And here with me, as always, to break down the upcoming enemy quarterback that the Eagles will be facing this week. Also, take a look back at some Carson Wentz and break down his game, and perhaps a look around the league as well, is quarterback one in my heart. He is Mark Schofield. Mark, how you doing, brother?
We meet again, Mr. Kist. Michael, it's great to be back with you again. Always a super fun time on the QB SCO Show. And as always, it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, a little bit of history. And we on familiar ground for my co-host. As those of you watching on News Channel 8 can see, I am holding up histories from Herodotus, the Tom Holland translation, and a book rendered to me by our learned co-host here on the QB SCO Show. And I have this in my hand, Michael, because just a few days ago, we got a bit of a request from Charles Cassidy on Twitter. Homst, you can follow on Twitter at C for Clarity. And this was his request, complete with a GIF or a GIF if you're crazy. Okay, so at Michael Kist NFL and at Mark Schofield, a violation to ask about the Battle of Thermopylae on the next pod? And Michael, of course, this is a request I'm all too willing to honor. Now, we don't have enough time to give this battle like the full attention it deserves. I mean, it spawned movies, some incredible work, even the modern era. But I did want to read from Herodotus for a moment, and I quote.
Can I correct you on that? Say it with me. Say it with me. Herodotus.
Herodotus.
There you go.
Herodotus. That's I want my to guy. Read from Herodotus
there
for
you
a
go.
Moment.
Let it flow.
In the midst of their deliberation, Xerxes sent a scout out on horseback to spy out their numbers and to see what they were up to. Xerxes had already heard, while still in Thessaly, that a tiny force had assembled in the past, led by the Lacedaemonians under Leonidas, and that Leonidas was of the bloodline of Heracles. The horsemen came galloping up to the camp and duly made a survey, though not of the whole camp, since it was impossible for him to see most of the troops who were stationed behind the wall, which they had repaired and were now in garrison. Instead, the scout took stock of the men who were out in the open, with their arms and armor piled up in front of the wall, and who at the time, as it happened, were the Lacedaemonians. Some of the men the scout saw, to his astonishment, were exercising naked, and some were combing their hair. Keeping his eyes peeled, however, he added up their numbers, and then, once he had arrived at an accurate total, galloped off unhindered. Rather than pursuing him, everyone treated him with the utmost indifference. And so he went back to Xerxes and reported all he had seen. Now, Michael, I bring this up and I want to ask you a question here. This image of the Spartans, the Lacedaemonians, knowing they faced certain death, knowing they were outnumbered, knowing that they were going to hold this tiny pass at the stake of their lives, exercising naked and just relaxingly combing their hair. How does that contrast with, say, two fan bases of teams that will meet on Sunday night, perhaps to determine their own futures? How does the almost calm nature of the Spartans contrast with what we've seen from, say, Cowboys and Eagles Twitter this past week?
I wish we had some calm. I wish I was exercising naked, combing my, you know, everyone knows I have this just luscious hair. There is such a freak out, hit every panic button in the room, pull every fire alarm moment type deal going on with Cowboys and Eagles Twitter. In a way, I think it's bringing the two fan bases together only to completely destroy them at the pass in Thermopylae when the battle really begins. So yeah, it's an interesting contrast between the two. And it's funny because this is a topic that today just seems to keep finding me with the Battle of Thermopylae. Someone in Betz's mentions said, explain how Leonidas and the 300 Spartans could have won if they came on a 4-3 over front with him playing single high as a high spear thrower. And Betz is like, yo, this is Michael Kist already. And I'm like literally reading Herodotus at the time.
Right.
And then I turn on Netflix to put on something for the kid who's sick with an ear infection. The main thing they're playing on Netflix at the top is the preview for 300, the movie, which I have mixed opinions on. It's over the top. It's fun. It's gore. It's extremely inaccurate and xenophobic. But, you know.
Other than that, though, how was it? Yeah.
I mean, when it was released, you can understand the political machinations going on behind that. But we won't get into politics. Let's not talk about that.
Let's not make everybody mad.
What you're saying is, it is Dallas week. And boy, everybody is freaking out. 2-3-3 teams battling for the top of the division, seeing who can get right. And this game might go a long way in determining the future success of the different paths that these teams take throughout the season. Because Dallas has a chance to get right on offense. The Eagles have a chance to get right on defense. And there's good reasons for both when you look at what's happening with both these teams right now, which is interesting. I don't know if it's a lasting result that comes out of this, but it's going to be one that's a lot of people are going to be barking about. So let's dig into it. I mean, this is the classic Carson Wentz versus Dak Prescott debate. And I don't think we're going to necessarily dig too far in that debate. Number one, I think Carson Wentz is playing a high level of football. Number two, I think Dak Prescott's playing a high level of football. You watched that Jets game. I thought he was good and didn't get a whole lot of help from the people around him. And he was the most pressured quarterback for the week. Both of his tackles missing. Amari Cooper goes out, which is obviously a devastating blow to that offense. I mean, we could talk about roster construction and how that shouldn't necessarily happen. But the Eagles have had some stumbles without DeSean Jackson in there, too. So, you know, I mean, we get it. But Mark, looking at these two quarterbacks, we'll start with the Eagles. We'll start with Carson Wentz. Some missed opportunities in this game against the Vikings. I mean, me and Benjamin Solak already documented like two big ones. The missed blitz pickup by Jordan Howard that probably would have led to a touchdown to Zach Ertz if he picks up the right guy. Alshon Jeffrey inexplicably going out of bounds on a perfectly placed pass by Wentz. Just things not hitting for Wentz, not getting a lot of help. I mean, these two quarterbacks, the Eagles have 17 drops. The Cowboys have 16 drops. Leads the league. Top two. Yeah, it doesn't get any worse than that when it comes from the supporting cast. So what have you thought about Wentz to this point?
I think what we saw in that game last week against Minnesota sort of tracks with what we've seen from him this season, which is he's played extremely well. You know, you go through that game, you go through some of the incompletions, you go through some of the misses. Like you said, the Mitz Blitz pickup, which didn't make sense to me at all. Like you had to think, you know, Howard's got to go inside out there. And the fact that he didn't just made no sense to me. You know, I went back through this game multiple times and I found just one decision from Carson Wentz where I was like, I don't agree with the decision that he had here. And it was on a 3rd-and-2 at the 9:47 mark of the second quarter. They're at the Minnesota 49. They've got a 12 personnel package with a double Y wing to the left. And they run basically a curls concept. And it's similar to Jet Colt and Jet Stallion in the Eagles playbook, which are route concepts where you read inside out. And so he throws the inside curl to Dallas Goedert, and he forces it in between two underneath defenders. But I think if you look to the outside curl to Ertz, there's sort of a bubble from the corner that's trying to come down to cover that route late. I think if Wentz comes off that inside curl quicker and goes to the outside curl, he's got a chance to complete this and keep this drive alive. And I say that like that's a decision I disagree with in the sense that I think he should have come off that first read quicker than he did. I understand why he made this throw. It's 3rd-and-2. You've got to get the ball out. And your first read is technically open, so you make that throw. I understand why he did it, but I think he could have come to that outside curl from Ertz and made a better throw and a better decision. Like you're seeing it right now with that corner that's a little bit off. You've got a better natural bubble there. Yeah. That's literally the only play of his from this game where I'm like, I don't think he made the right read. The rest of this game I thought was, I don't want to say flawless, but it was a well-executed game from him. And, you know, he didn't
Mark,
get a ton
if,
of
if
help.
If I put up this throw, I'm sorry to cut you off, but if I put up this throw on Twitter, which I made because we do a lot of video previews for these, so we can give you, gentle listeners, some visuals of what we're talking about here. We had a great one from last week where Mark broke down a play. I threw some graphics on it, took all the credit for it. But on this play, on this 3rd-and-2, when you watch this, what about, because a lot of people are going to say, well, why not throw this up to Jeffrey? You give him a chance. That's his strength, right? What would you say to counter that, or would you kind of agree with that? I know it's 3rd-and-2. I know the drop, but like, is there any credence to that?
I don't have this exact play in a playbook that I have access to, so I don't know the true progression reads. I'm working off of two different route concepts: Jet Colt, Jet Stallion, where they have curls, and you're reading that 1-2.
Yeah, he's obviously looking towards like the spacing towards the left. That's where he starts. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he's going on this one, the inside curl from Goddard, the outside curl from Ertz, and then the route in the flat from the running back. Like that's his read. Yeah. And a lot of the plays in the Eagles playbook, look, they've got man read and zone read. Mm-hmm. And here he gets zone coverage. So he's working the zone concept with the two curls sitting down in space. If he saw man, then you probably might look to Jeffrey on this dino post route to the backside, to the right, because that's a man beater route. Mm-hmm. And you might have a chance to make that throw. And then if you come off of that, you've got the other receiver in the flat. you're running that arrow route, so you go dino post to curl if you get man coverage. Here he sees zone, and he makes that. So I don't have a problem with him reading to this side of the field.
Yep.
The only other thing to highlight on this play is he does hitch for a second.
Yeah.
Like, he starts to throw, he starts to pull the trigger, and then waits. If he doesn't have that hitch, there might be a window to throw that inside curl route. But, or if he doesn't have that hitch, throw the other curl route.
I agree, yeah.
It's just the hitch there. And look, sometimes it happens. Your eyes don't mesh with the mind. Your eyes don't mesh with the muscle memory. You hesitate for a second. Sometimes that happens. But again, we're spending like 5 minutes now breaking down a 3rd and 2, which was probably his one mistake of the game. And even then, it's kind of a push.
Yeah, and I think that hitch happens because the player, Harrison Smith, collisions Zach Ertz, and what Wentz wants right there is the running back coming out to the flat. But as soon as he sees Smith comes off, that's when he kind of reholsters it, and then that causes the delay of timing. Like, there's so many different layers to this one little play, and ultimately, I think you're right. Like, yeah, he could have done better at this, but you could see why there was some delay there and why it went wrong.
Remember that all of this happens in the span of 3 seconds, okay?
We don't get to slow motion.
We don't get to sit here, slow motion this, bounce ideas off of each other, bounce potential reads and questions off of each other.
Yeah.
Wentz has 3 seconds here, okay? Yeah. And he has 3 seconds while he's got, you know, the hoplites and the Persians like storming the pocket, ready to kick him off a cliff.
Yeah.
It's hard to really crush a guy for snap decisions like this. And again, I just want to reiterate and underline and put it in boldface 42-point font. This was the one mistake I found. Not the back shoulder throw to Alshon Jeffrey that let him out of bounds. Give me a break with that one. Quote. That was a perfect ball. Give me a break with that. I mean, look, there are routes in playbooks where you either throw it over the top or you throw it back shoulder, depending on what you've seen. For example, rub concept in the Patriots playbook. If you get that corner that gets rubbed by the slant route, if he comes underneath, you throw it over the top. If he goes over the top of the rub, you turn that into a back shoulder throw on the wheel route on the fly. So there are times when you do that. That route in question to Jeffrey was not ever going to be a back shoulder throw unless you had coverage over the top, which in this case, the only thing over the top was the end zone. There was nothing else over the top of that. So now, back shoulder, get out of here with that.
Yeah. Overall, his performance, I think I cut you off before you could make your big point about what you think about Wentz from this game, but I think you kind of laid it out there.
Yeah.
Not many mistakes, not many things to nitpick. Like, there are times where, like, I think his placement can definitely be better throughout the season. I think that's just a general statement overall. But again, I mean, brother, at some point, let me ask you this, because I've played around with this a lot, and more so, like, after the Falcons game and with the drop from Aguilar, and then the Lions game with the drop from Jay-Jaw, and Dallas Goedert had one in the end zone as well. And then this game, it just seems like when they need a break, they can't get one. They almost come back from 24-3 to tie it up if Alshon doesn't go out of bounds, and then later on the blitz pick up. But at what point does Carson Wentz, seeing the success that the Eagles had in 2017 in the playoffs without him, does he start to think that maybe he's a little snake bitten? And does that ever get into his head, do you think? Maybe just a little bit?
I'm certainly not one to play armchair psychologist, although I do all the time on Twitter. But at the same time, like, it's hard not to. You know, it's hard not to, that sort of level of doubt, not in yourself, but perhaps in those around you, to start to sort of creep in when you make good reads and good throws and there's the lack of success or a lack of production. It's human nature. I mean, Mike, every time we do this show, you probably walk away thinking, man, I had to carry this guy through another episode. Like, at some point, I got to get something on the other end of the microphone here. So it's just human nature to sort of feel let down, underwhelmed, disappointed in those around you. And so whether it reflects his play is another thing. The thing that we might start to see is when start to press.
I was going to say,
sort of that quicksand type thing where it's like, you know, things might be going against you. So you start trying to be too fine with your reads, too fine with your throws. Maybe you see more hesitation in double clutch moments like we saw, because you're like, are we going to complete this if I throw it? And that's when you might sort of see it impact on the field. And so, to bring it back to this 3rd and 2, if you start to see more stuff like that, where it's almost like you can see the doubt creep into his mind on a read or a throw, then you might start to wonder if that really is happening to him in his mind.
Yeah, that's kind of where I wanted to kind of give that overall view of what it might look like later on with that doubt creeping in. Hopefully that doesn't happen. Hopefully the Eagles offense can get on track. against this Dallas Cowboys defense that hasn't really been all that good. But when we come back here on the QB Sco Show, we are going to talk about the quarterback on the opposite side. We're going to be talking about some Dak Prescott. That's coming up next here on the QB Sco Show. And we are back here on the QB Sco Show, episode 37, Bleeding Green Nation, SB Nation, Michael Kist, here with QB1 in all of our hearts, Mark Schofield. Mark, let's talk about some Dak. I already kind of alluded to it before. The Jets game for Dak, some placement issues, a smattering of placement issues throughout the game. It never felt like the offense was in a rhythm. Michael Gallup couldn't catch a cold. Amari Cooper goes out. There were a lot of parallels in this game with Cowboys and Jets that I felt matched up really well with Eagles and Falcons coming into it with the drops and, you know, guys that you think are going to be on the field for you not being there and whatnot, and some key plays being missed by the wide receivers. So I thought Dak played well, despite what the stats might say or what others might say. It definitely wasn't his best game. And overall, this is a declining offense when it comes to the production that they're getting. I mean, you go from weeks 1 through 3 to weeks 4 through 6, you're seeing a drop in yards per attempt from 9.8 down to 8.2. Pressure rates, by the way, up 21% to 44%. The red zone production got cut in half after being just fantastic. The running game hasn't been as good. They aren't scoring their touchdown and turnover drive frequency are the same in the last three games. So there's a lot of things wrong with this offense. Other than them not doing as much play action, I'm not sure how it happened this way.
Yeah, and I think it does come back to the play action, because it's not that they're not doing as much of it. Through those first 3 weeks, they ran play action on 39.4% of their passes, which was second highest in the league.
Yep.
It's down over the last three to 17.2%, which is tied for third fewest in the league.
Yep.
And yeah, there might be some game script stuff in there that might play a role, but that's a big drop. And it's led people to believe that Jason Garrett has started to take a little bit more of an import in the game plan and the game call and the game script. And because we were talking about Wonder Kid, you know, Kellen Moore a couple of weeks ago, when this offense was clicking, like you said, in the first 3 weeks, a lot of it based off of play action. And now, look, you know what I saw too much in this game from Dallas? Slot fade to the tight end, okay? When you're running slot fade to Jason Witten coming out of the slot, a dude that was just in the booth a couple of months ago, like, that's probably not a way to generate offense, running slot fade to Jason Witten.
That was the one in the end zone, right?
Yeah.
And you wonder why it's over thrown.
Yeah. It's because he's expecting the guy to get there and he can't get there. So I was confused by that. I'm confused by the lack of play action. As far as Dak himself, like, this was a typical Dak game. He made some plays. He made some reads and throws and sort of scramble drill situations. But you also saw some bad placement at time. They ran sort of a dagger-type concept, I think, 2nd and 8 at 6:27 of the second quarter. And he's got a window to make a throw. And the throw is late. The throw is high. It's incomplete. Now, it's catchable, but
yeah. It's
not where it should be. And that's sort of been always the issue with Dak, dated back to Mississippi State, which was the placement isn't always as crisp as it needs to be. And when you've got protection problems, when you're playing with backup offensive linemen and he's getting pressured and pressure impacts ball placement, when you've got drop issues from the receivers and then throws aren't exactly on target, and so it's tough for them to make catches, that is sort of that like mishmash snowball of ineptitude. And that's what we sort of saw at times from this offense. I did like some of their designs. You know, I liked a play that I really liked, 3rd and 9 at the 11-minute mark of the third quarter. They come out on the 3-by-1. And it looks like 4 verts because you're getting that bender from number 3 from left to right, I believe. But it's really just curls from the other guys. The bender stays vertical on the post, but you really sort of sell that 4 verts concept out of a 3-by-1. Defensive backs stay over the top of it. It gives you some easy curl routes to complete. I did like that design.
Yeah.
That's something to sort of think about. And you might see some double moves based off of that this week. We know Eagles history with double moves and things like that. So
you put it in the universe.
Yeah, you put it out into the universe. It's going to happen. I mean, look, we all called it before, you know, Super Bowl 52. We all said the double move was coming and it did. And the Eagles were able to overcome that one. So maybe they overcome this on Sunday night. But for Dak, I think there was some nice stuff from him. Some of the issues we usually see with Dak. But it's that play action, I think, and that lack of consistency using it, which has really held this offense back recently.
Yeah, and I agree. And when you're coming in to face the Eagles, you see what the Vikings did with play action and their boot game and everything. You have to kind of get back to that. And this is interesting. There's two different points that I wanted to bring up with you. number one, I've seen guys like Brian Brodus, who are around guys in the building and have been around that organization for a long time, saying that Kellen Moore is still the one in charge of the play calling, because I think a lot of the Cowboys fans want to put this on Jason Garrett, because they don't want to believe. Because if it's not Jason Garrett, there is no hope for this offense. Because if it's Kellen Moore, you're screwed. Because, I mean, Jason Garrett was around Scott Linehan for years, could have said no at any point. Apparently, he's given free rein to Kellen Moore, and we're seeing what happens when they're playing decent defenses, and it's not looking fantastic. So that's an interesting conversation about who's actually doing what in that building.
You know that Cowboys fans are just waiting for the day that Jason Garrett gets kicked off the cliff.
Yeah.
Again, to use a 300 reference, because you saw the imagery of him like trying to high five players as they were coming off the sideline at MetLife Stadium, and they want nothing to do with that guy. Like, they would rather stick their hands into burning hot fire than to acknowledge the presence of Jason Garrett. And so that looks bad.
Yeah.
Now, it could just be like, look, like with screenshot scouting, you can catch a glimpse of something and then you can make it say something that actually doesn't. But it does seem like, at least over the past couple of weeks, he's starting to lose this locker room. And he's been there a long time. Cowboys fans want nothing more than to see him get sent the door. So they want to pin this on him. But if he still has turned this over to Kellen Moore, and this is Moore's offense, and he's the one calling slot fade to Jason Witten, you know, on the high in out of the high red zone.
And 50-50 run pass ratios on first downs and early downs,
Like, that's not the wonder kid that was promised to us. Like, we were promised a guy that had his own playbook when he was six, okay? And when he was drawing it with, like, crayons, because he's that big of a football mind. If this is what this guy's dialing up, like you said, it's a big letdown from what we saw in the first 3 weeks.
Yeah, and they're still doing motions. They're still doing a ton of formation shifts. Yep. They're still giving information pre-snap to the quarterback about whether it's man, zone, you know, matchups, all that stuff. That's big for a quarterback. They just there's something lacking there. I'll tell you what's not lacking, though, and this is the other point that I wanted to bring up with Dak Prescott especially. This dude is tough.
Yeah.
This dude took some shots in this game, stood in there, and delivered, and would have taken more and stood in there. You can say a lot of things about Dak. You can say he's a moderately accurate quarterback. You can say he's a quarterback that needs a strong supporting cast around him. A lot of quarterbacks are. You cannot say that this guy is not a gamer and not willing to put his body on the line, man. I was impressed with the way that he stood strong in the pocket. Even if it wasn't perfect placement, I don't care. He was not scared, took some shots, and he did not wilt.
Yeah, and that dates back to his days at Mississippi State. Yeah. And that's where I think a lot of people missed on Dak Prescott, because a lot of people sort of – look, I had him like QB 17. Like, I had him behind Christian Hackenberg in that class. And when he had the success he had as a rookie, I went back and I try to do this every year, like revisit my rankings from a couple of years prior. And so I looked back at all my notes on him, and, you know, his final year as a junior, he had a game against Alabama, and this was when Mississippi State was highly ranked, and it was a huge game, and they lost, but he battled into the fourth quarter. He was getting beat up, and playing that Alabama defense is as tough a test as you will see as a college quarterback, because it's basically an NFL defense from talent and scheme combined. But he battled late into that game, threw touchdown late, and I wrote down and highlighted a competitive toughness plus mark. I just didn't incorporate that into sort of my final evaluation of him. But that was a thing that he had coming out. It's part of what made him the guy that could come in as a fourth round pick and take over this team due to injury. He made himself better because he did get better as a rookie in terms of ball placement and stuff like that. And yes, he had help around him, but you can't question this dude's competitive toughness. You can question the placement. You can question the offense. You can question a lot of other things, but not that thing. He checks that box in, you know, a huge way.
Definitely. Let's talk about Sam Darnold and his performance against the Cowboys, because we can make some parallels as to far as how he hurt the Cowboys and how maybe that translates for the Eagles. Sam Darnold comes back from mono. Looks good, man. I mean, the difference
mono
between
free Sammy D.
Sammy D. Big T D. Anyway, a little big mouth reference there. Sammy D comes back. And the difference between him and Falk is just absolutely night and day, just not from not serviceable just to solid. And I liked Sam Darnold when I watched him in the offseason. He had a nice little run at the end of the season coming into this one. I thought that we showed some promising stuff. I think he's going to be a perfectly cromulent quarterback. What did he do against the Cowboys that led to some success in the passing game for them?
I want to start with a tweet that our mutual friend Evan Silva put out earlier this week after that game. And he said, Jets quarterback Sam Darnold is 1 month younger than Dwayne Haskins, 7 months younger than Drew Locke, 11 months younger than Gardner Minshew, nearly 2 years younger than Mason Rudolph, over 2 years younger than Baker Mayfield, and nearly 3 years younger than mediocre Mitchell Trubisky.
Did he say mediocre Mitch?
Because no, I took a little bit of license there. I took a little bit of license there. We can't date him from ripping from the QB Sco show, or actually from ripping from Michael J. Kist, but he's going to be good.
Yeah.
Like, as a Patriots fan, like, I can see, like, a year or two now saying, all right.
The shift.
Sam Darnold is here now, and he's the best quarterback in this division because he's young. He's relatively new to the position. Again, he was a linebacker until his sophomore year in high school. And so, like, a lot of this muscle memory stuff that other guys have by this point isn't really ingrained in him as much as I think we see from other quarterbacks. Mm. The pocket movement, the ability to keep the eyes downfield. Look, credit to Adam Gase in this game because they get the ball late in the fourth quarter. They stayed aggressive.
Yeah,
like they had the scramble drill throw downfield where he found Crowder in a scramble drill situation. They had the back shoulder to Robbie Anderson.
They were doing stuff like intermediate to the sidelines. I was impressed. Yeah.
Yeah. There was like 5 minutes left in the game. And they needed those points because, look, they punt there. They go three and out, run it three times and punt. Mm. Dallas wins that game. So they stayed aggressive. Credit to Gase. I was very impressed with Darnold in this game. Loved some of the vertical stuff that they were doing. A thing that Philadelphia can keep in mind for this game, and I think you're going to see a lot of what Philadelphia calls Falcon or Sparrow. Hmm. And these are just drive concepts, right? And we know drive dates back to the Bill Walsh days. They used it with Rice's Z drive where he runs basically the shallow. You get the tight end, you know, Russ Francis sort of on the deep dig route over the top. They did this a lot with both Demaryius Thomas and Jamison Crowder, where you get Crowder working underneath and they get the dig route over the top. You do that, you show the linebackers the routes in front. We know those Dallas linebackers, young, athletic, they're going to collapse on that stuff. It gives you that dig route over the top. So expect to see that dig route play a big role Sunday. Darnold threw it a bunch off these concepts. They did with NCAA Mills as well. We have the post, the dig, and the shallow. But dig routes, I think you got to show those linebackers something in front of them, dig routes behind them for big gains.
Yeah, third quarter, 6:57 on a 2nd and 10. I mean, they did this a bunch in the game, but it's just one example.
Yeah,
but you
hit that 2nd and 10, the shallow, the dig route over the top. Yeah,
yeah, and they had a lot of success of going over the top of these linebackers in this game, which is something that hopefully the Eagles can take away from, learn from, and then apply into their game plan. Okay, so that's Sammy D, Wentz, and Dak. All right, we covered the three that we were supposed to cover. There's an amalgamation of a quarterback out there that you're a big fan of. Who is it, Mark?
If you had to ask me right now, my QB1 in the National Football League, it is generic Atlanta opposing quarterback, okay? Because I just want to shout out what this quarterback has done. To date, he has completed 137 of 192 passes, a 71.4 completion percentage, which would be third overall amongst any quarterback right now, okay?
Yeah.
For 1,627 yards, 15 touchdowns, just 2 interceptions, and an adjusted net yards per attempt of 9.3, which is behind only Patrick Mahomes. So generic Atlanta opposing quarterback is my favorite quarterback in the league right now. And you know why, Mike? It's partly because Atlanta can't cover anybody, okay? Yeah. They just can't cover anybody. I was watching that game that Kyler Murray had against them.
Oh, yeah.
And that huge, that 31-yard gain on a flat route to Johnson out of the backfield, this comes on a 1st and 10, okay? Yeah. This comes with a middle-of-the-field open coverage. So they've got, I think it's Larry Fitz running the deep post route, and they got that. They bracketed, my friend. Like, they ain't throwing that route. But when he checks it down, Murray does, to Johnson in the left flat to a route that is 5 yards downfield, there is not an Atlanta defender within, I swear to God, 35 yards of him.
Yeah. Like, it took them forever just to get near him.
Nobody close. I don't understand how it happens. And every Sunday night or Monday, you can go on the timeline and you can see somebody's got the gif of the dots and it's a play against Atlanta. And there are just receivers running wide open. It's to the point where I think if I were generic Atlanta opposing quarterback, not that I'd put up numbers like this, but I could complete some throws in the NFL against this defense. And we always have those things on Twitter like, okay, if you were given 5 carries against the Dallas defense, how many yards could you get? And people are like, oh, I could get 25. It's like, no, you couldn't.
No, you can't.
Like, come on. Let's be real here. You would get killed. Like, usually that's how I answer those questions. I would die on the field. I don't know, man. I think people on the timeline could complete some throws against this Atlanta defense right now.
Would you right now be in favor of firing Dan Quinn and hiring Jay Gruden, because I really feel like they're wasting. Matt Ryan's playing good ball. Matt Ryan put up points in this game.
Matt Ryan's playing well.
Yeah.
He's playing well in this game. He's having a good year. I mean, you look at some of the numbers that he's put up. I mean, again, adjusted net yards per attempt, it's just one stat, but he's ninth in the league right now, 6.96. It's nowhere near his 2016 numbers, where his MVP, which was just off the charts, but he's putting up good numbers.
I think he could get closer to those 2016 numbers with a guy like Gruden instead of what they got going on with Dirk Cutter and then Dan Quinn running the show. I don't know what's going on with Atlanta. They got to do something there. They're too talented for that.
They are too talented. Do you fire Quinn, go Cutter? Let Cutter run the show and
No.
You've got to do something, right? This isn't working.
It can't be Cutter, though. You got to fire Dan Quinn. But yeah, I mean, they might need to have a placeholder, like an interim head coach. I would still, even in that situation, I would get the trebuchet ready, fire him into the moon, and I don't know, bring in Bill Callahan after the Washington team fires him for being an incompetent head coach. By the way, great for them for establishing the run. You beat the team.
They established it.
They established the heck out of it. They beat a team that's actively trying to lose by 1 point.
Did they really win that game?
No, nobody won that game.
Really? No. You know who lost that game? I lost that game because that was one of our local games here in the D.C. area. And I got stuck watching that one and trying to explain to my son and daughter why we were watching a game between two teams that had yet to win a game. Like, I felt like a true failure as a parent and as a dad.
That's amazing. My son
probably went to school the next to me like, I don't like my dad anymore. Like, it's just depressing.
Yeah. So fire Dan Quinn. Bring in Jay Gruden. I don't know. Everybody should bring in Jay Gruden if you're struggling on offense. I don't know what Washington's doing. Fascinating to see that too. They're establishing. We are established. Speaking of which, we're going to establish our way right on out of here. Mark, any last thoughts before we go? I don't know what that transition was, but
I have no idea. Just remember, friends, keep on sending in those submissions, the logo submissions for the official QB Scotia swag. We're going to get ready to make a decision. We'd like to get these out. I don't know if we could do it for the holidays, but soon, but please keep on sending those in. And of course, keep on sending in the references, the historical things you'd like to hear us talk about. Could be, you know, something that's not Greek history, so we can get out of, you know, KISS's realm and perhaps more a more familiar territory for me. But as always, friends, thanks for the love. Thanks for listening.
That's all we got.
That's all we need.
Was that a cock?
Something. Cuckoo.
GN.